Well, are you finding yourself with more tomatoes or zucchini than you can possibly eat? Do you wish you could enjoy all that bounty in the middle of February? Well, I think we've all been there. Hi, Jill Nadeau here, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk. On the phone with me from her home in Virginia is Barbara Pleasant. She's an award-winning writer who has over 30 years of experience growing and writing about organic vegetable gardening. Her latest book is Homegrown Pantry, a gardener's guide to selecting the best varieties and planting the perfect amounts for what you want to eat year-round. She's also contributed to another new book, Mother Earth News Guide to Vegetable Gardening. What do you want to know about growing the perfect amount of produce? Do you have questions about organic vegetable gardening? Well, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org or put something on our Facebook page. Just look for The Larry Mueller Show. Barbara, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Jill. It's great to be here.
So are you having as much rain in Virginia as we are having in Wisconsin this year?
I wish we could have a little bit more.
Oh, we can ship you some.
It's supposed to rain today, and in fact, I heard thunder a few minutes ago.
Okay. So I'm looking at your books, and they're absolutely gorgeous. Your pantry book is a wonderful book, a wonderful addition to anybody's gardening bookshelf. And, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, I'll bet you a lot of people are thinking to themselves, why would I want to go through all that work? That looks like a lot of work. Why is it worth it?
Well, you know, that very concern held me back from writing the book for a long time, because I thought, I don't want to lead people down a primrose path and, you know, give them the Pinterest version. Oh, this is easy. Anybody can do it. Yeah. Because it really is more of a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
But now, when you look at how life is today, why else would you want to garden? Well, other than to have truly superior things to eat all year round, and which is very different than gardening for self-sufficiency. I'm not up for that.
Oh, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of work. So do you basically kind of take a few things that you know are extra good and focus on that?
Well, one of the things that has really broadened gardeners' horizons is that when you talk about food preservation now, you're not just talking about canning.
Right.
You're talking about drying. I dry more tomatoes than I can these days. Fermentation. I love cabbage and I love kraut. And so I have found that I'm growing more cabbage every season so I can make more fermented vegetables.
You're not alone on that one. Everybody wants to ferment.
You know, so
right?
It's not like we're talking about being chained to the canner all summer, which is actually my least favorite food preservation method, because it's hot and
and it's the middle of the summer when you're doing it, right? Timing on that's not
and
great.
It's usually, we have apples and pears, and so that, you know, stretches way into
sure,
September.
Sure. Now, you are an organic gardener, and you've been doing this for 30 years, so you are kind of way ahead of the big organic push. What appealed to you back then about this way of growing?
Because it just made so much sense to me that, and not just the absence of pesticides. When I came of age in gardening, everyone used fertilizer meant using 10-10-10,
uh-huh.
A chemical fertilizer, which is nothing evil about it, but I wouldn't want my whole garden to depend on it.
Right.
And some of the pesticides that used to be legal are gone now, but it was still scary. And so much has changed, even on the pesticide question. Now more and more people use row covers to protect plants that are at imminent risk of some type of pest. And we know the garden pests better, you know, like you can almost predict when they're going to show up.
Yes.
And some years are different than others. But I think getting into the organic groove was part of, you know, the initial counterculture revolution back in the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
And now today, it's that if most gardeners think, well, if I'm going to go to all this trouble, why not grow the very best?
Right. So, and not only grow the best, but keep it so that I have it in my pantry all year long, right?
Right. And organic gardening is not as challenging as it once was, because you can go to any box store and buy organic fertilizer, and there's, if you were looking at pesticides and don't want to have to learn to pronounce a lot of words that have many syllables,
right,
there's a little seal called the OMRI, the OMRI seal. It stands for Organic Materials Review Institute. If there's that little black and white OMRI seal on a product, that means that it's legal for organic growers to use, you know, under certain guidelines. And that the way that product was manufactured has also been looked at with an eye toward pollution and other concerns. So,
oh, that's good information. So MRI or
OMRI. Organic, if you just, oh, it's something that starts with an O, then you're going to get
got
there.
It. Okay, well, good information. Now, tell us a little bit about what else is in your book besides the different preservation methods.
Well, of course, some things don't need to be preserved. They just need to be stored under good conditions. Potatoes is a good example. Onions, I'm just beginning to pull onions now. And if they get nicely dried, they'll last until I use up every last one. So the cool storage group should be pretty big. That includes winter squash, pumpkins, things that can just go in the basement.
Right.
And so that's one part of it. But I think more importantly, every year if you're a gardener and you get too much, you hit kind of a panic. Oh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do?
Those silent raids on your neighbor's doorstep, right? Yeah.
Here's some zucchini. So I guess I wanted to be that aunt that lives in the country that says, oh, it's okay. Here's what you do. You could try this. You could make that. You know.
Yes.
Right. Or you can throw it in the freezer and deal with it later.
And that's always a good suggestion, too. So yeah. I noticed that you freeze some of your things and make, like, jam and things later on in the year.
Oh, yes. Like, we just finished picking 10 gallons of blueberries.
Oh, my gosh.
And that becomes kind of like a little yoga practice that you go out every morning.
Yes.
And do your quota. But all of them went in the freezer. I'm not going to stop and make jam or anything like that at this point.
Well, that's just common sense, yeah. Right.
Besides, here's one thing you learn when you start thinking in terms of a homegrown pantry is, you know what, you don't eat that much jam.
No.
You can easily make way more jam than you're really going to eat.
Right, right. Well, all great information, and we have a number of callers that are looking to talk to you, so let's go right away to Paul in La Crosse. Hi, Paul. What's your question for Barbara?
I've read about freeze-drying machines.
Yes.
Especially I've seen them in Mother Earth news, and I'm wondering, I mean, I'm expecting they work. I wondered if they've been used.
Well, they do work.
You basically use freeze drying like you used to see in different products.
Yes, because it gives a different result than straight up drying. It's a faster process that removes the moisture more rapidly, and so the cells don't kind of mush and contract as much. But they are costly. And so I would say I would not look at freeze drying unless you're not happy with regular dehydration.
What's the difference between the freeze drying and dehydration then? Just the time it takes?
Yeah, the time it takes, and the product comes out different.
Okay.
For example, let's talk about drying a strawberry, and you cut it in half.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to put it in a regular dehydrator, it's going to turn into a leathery thing to eat. And if you freeze-dry it, it's more of a crispy, almost like a popped strawberry.
Oh.
But now here I'll have to just digress a little bit from freeze-drying. What I like to do with the strawberries or cherries is to go ahead and cut them and freeze them with a little sugar, the same way you would if you were freezing them as a dessert topping.
Okay.
then take them out of the freezer when you have a good dehydrator day and dry them after they've been sugared and frozen. That's how you get dried cherries that taste like the ones in packages.
Oh, what a great tip. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, the sugar tenderizes them and makes them better.
Yeah, kind of like putting salt on a steak. Okay, very interesting. All right, well, great. Hopefully that helps you out there, Paul. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Don in Eau Claire. Hi, Don.
Yes, good morning. I'm 94 and a half years old now. My wife died a year and a half ago at 87. We had a long life together, a big garden. My wife used to can at least 30 quarts of tomatoes every year. We had dill pickles. We had frozen asparagus and everything else, you know. Anyway, towards the end, we boiled down to a few simple things. To do away with the canned tomatoes, I took to roasting tomatoes, just cutting them, oiling a flat pan with edges on, washing and just very lightly coring the tomatoes and cutting them in half from top to bottom. Putting them on the oil pan, taking a piece of paper toweling with olive oil on, oiling the surfaces, sticking them under the broiler for 20 minutes or as much required to blacken the surface. Take them out, let them cool, and with the tweezers and with a paring knife, just pick off the skins and then the tomatoes that were in the pan. We would simply scoop into quart bags or gallon bags, depending on how we wanted to roll them up, and stick them in the freezer. It was far simpler than the old canning process. They taste just as good, and it was a wonderful way.
Well, you know, with the roasting, they may taste even better.
Right.
Yeah. And then some years we always ended up with a lot of green tomatoes. My wife's oldest cookbook was a Meta Gibbons 2-volume series. It has an excellent recipe in it for green tomato mincemeat. If we were blessed with, or cursed, however we want to look at it, with a lot of green tomatoes, we had our share of fried green tomatoes from the Mexican novel and the recipe there. The rest we made green tomato mincemeat, which was great through the winter for pies.
Well, that's great, Don. That sounds like you used every little bit of your garden. That's wonderful. Barbara, is that pretty much normal for people who have gardens to use everything, whether they're ripe or not?
Well, especially when you're facing down, you know, winter starting and you're overloaded with green tomatoes,
yeah.
You know, yeah, you start doing all kinds of interesting things with them. Yeah, I guess you don't want to waste them. And then some things, you know, aren't just not worth it, like the immature peppers. Yeah, they don't taste good.
Yeah.
But you go to all the trouble to grow things, and then you want to use them up, and it's always a little sad when you find yourself throwing things away just because you didn't pick them. One of the rules I have for myself is the first thing that happens in the garden every day is to pick what's ready.
That's a very good rule to live by.
You see, because we gardeners, we like to plant.
Yes. That's a fun part.
We like to take on new projects and forget that, oh, yes, I need to go and pick that perfect lettuce.
Yes. So. Well, you're listening to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network today. And we're talking with Barbara Pleasant. She's an award-winning writer who has been covering organic gardening for over 30 years. What questions do you have for her about organic vegetable gardening, preserving food? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, coming up next week on Garden Talk, Jeff Epping from the Olbrich Gardens will be with us, and that's always a really interesting show, so hope you can join us for that. And right now, we're talking about organic vegetable gardening with Barbara Pleasant. Barbara, one of the pieces, the chart you have in one of your in your book is about when you should use up that stored food. And I know I'm guilty of having frozen vegetables in my freezer way too long. Can you kind of go over that information for us a little bit?
Well, sure. With the freezer, some depends on whether or not you use a vacuum sealer, because a vacuum sealer tends to add a little life to frozen foods because it just excludes all the air from the package. But now, I have a freezer, and in the springtime, I make myself clean it out. And, you know, it fortunately is old and needs defrosting, so that pushes me to get it done. But once a year, you do need to purge that freezer. Now, with the canned things, some of them will last 2 years. So with tomato sauce, canned tomatoes, homemade marinara sauces, homemade salsas, you can keep those in a cool, dark place for 2 years, and they will not lose quality. The same cannot be said for pickles. Pickles that are canned with vinegar usually start to soften often after a year, and so that's one of the lessons a new canner learns, is you have to stop making pickles at a certain point because
you can't use
they
them
really
all.
Only keep for a year. So.
You know, I did not know that, but I have had pickles that are kind of soft, so that would make sense. That would make
right.
sense.
Right, and so dried things, it depends on how they're stored. I have room in the door of my freezer to just put dried fruits and vegetables in. I use canning jars and just keep them frozen, and then I don't have to worry about humidity or other kinds of factors getting to them.
Well, that's a good idea. I guess I've never thought about taking the dried fruit or vegetables and putting them into the freezer to make them last longer, but that totally makes sense.
Yeah, and yeah. I think that, like, dried tomatoes would probably easily last 2 years, but I use them all up. I've gotten so used to having them for cooking that they're gone.
Yeah, and they're so flavorful, like you had said earlier. Well, let's go back to the phones. Mary in Pewaukee has a question for us.
Hi, Mary. I've just discovered that I now have the Japanese beetles. They have come back and started to attack.
Yes.
And I thought perhaps I might be able to buy an insecticide that was organic and allow me to use it on my vegetable garden as well as, you know, kill some of the other nasty bugs. But in reading some of the directions, it says it's toxic to bees.
That's true. Almost everything that you might spray on foliage that Japanese beetles would then eat and die from are toxic to bees. And one of the problems with Japanese beetles is they can just go from one crop to another. They were on my corn one day last week, then the next day they're on the beans, and then the next day they found the roses, but they move around.
They're not picky.
And grapes, oh, they love those.
Mm-hmm.
The good thing about Japanese beetles is they only feed for 6 weeks. The bad thing about them is, as you know, they'll eat and have sex at the same time. It's pretty disgusting. We keep a jar with soapy water out around the garden, and whenever someone's in the mood, they pick it up and just go around and tap the beetles in. It makes me feel better. And then more may come. I would caution you not to use the Japanese beetle traps unless you have a large piece of property and can locate them downwind from your garden, because they attract Japanese beetles that would not otherwise be in your yard.
Great. Yes, and we've heard that from a number of our guests before. So, well, good luck, Mary, but maybe you can get some of your stress out by actually putting them in that soapy water, right? We're talking with Barbara Pleasant today, and we have open lines. So please give us a call. We want to hear what your questions are about vegetable gardening or preserving food. The number is 800-642-1234. And we're going to go back to the phones and talk to Stephen in Mount Pleasant. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. I'm considering putting in a lot of raised beds and being organic, and I can't find any information as to what I can use for the sides. I'm considering using a quarter-inch plastic hurricane type mesh.
Is this for lining them or for doing tunnels?
No, for just the sides, because I'm going to make them 2 foot tall, and I need something to keep the dirt from going all over.
Okay.
So you're going to make them almost planter size, 2 feet
right.
tall.
2x4x86.
Boy, you do have a big project going on.
Yes, wow.
Okay, well, if it was a smaller project, one of the materials I would say to look at is decking planks, which are made from, they're composite lumber, and they will last forever. They're costly, and they're a little bit heavy, but they're handled just like wood, and they're termite-proof, and they seldom warp. However, that's a big project you have going there, and you're looking at what material?
Well, I'm looking at for information as to what organic certification will allow me to use.
Oh, well, in that case, I'm going to have to say you will better check with your certifying agency on that question, because I don't know. You know, my own garden is a terraced garden because it's on a hillside. And so one side of each bed is retained with just untreated wood. And when we use the thicker planks, like 1.5 inches thick, we don't see a lot of deterioration, and they don't need to be replaced but about every 4 years. So,
does that kind of answer your question then, Stephen?
No, working on it.
Okay.
I've seen people using corrugated steel, like you'd use on roofs, I suppose. I think that's the newest material I've seen. But I haven't seen a certified organic operation with anything except plain wood beds, so I don't know.
Okay, well, if anybody has any ideas out there, please just give us a call. And let's just go right back to the phones. Thanks for the call, Stephen. Paula is online from Northwest Illinois. Hi, Paula.
Hi. I have a suggestion and a question. I also clean my freezer out every spring, and I use all my bits and pieces of vegetables that I haven't used up over the winter, and I make soups and stews.
Good idea.
Sounds like a great right. idea.
Mm-hmm. And that way I can also use the bits of meat that I've got left over. And the other question I have, I let my radishes and my lettuce go to seed, and I caught my granddaughter the other day eating my seed pods from the radishes. She said, "These are really good, Grandma. They taste just like peas."
Oh, dear.
And I wondered.
They are good. And, you know, there are certain varieties that are just grown for their pods. They're called rat tail radishes.
Oh.
And they have pods that get 3 to 4 inches long.
Awesome. Well, good. I'll get to start using them like that then.
I guess. Well, your daughter or your granddaughter knows what she's talking about, apparently. Thanks.
That's good. I've been trying to teach her organic. So.
Well, good for you. Thank you, Paula. You know, talking about that, Barbara, you had mentioned in your book that you used to help your mom garden and preserve, and that kind of got that gardening bug in you. Do you have any ways that you try to get kids involved in gardening?
Well, you know, kids really enjoy gardening. They like watching things grow, and they don't mind getting their hands dirty. And so a lot of times children will want to be part of the garden. And I think if you can, giving them their own little space, and, of course, depending on the age of the child, once a gardening child is 9 or 10 years old, they are on autopilot. They pretty much know what they want to do and get down to it. But with the younger kids, giving them a little raised bed with lots of things they can water, it gives them that nurturing feeling, and they love watering things and, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've got Nancy on the line from Madison. Hi, Nancy. What question do you have for Barbara?
Hi, Barbara. Hi, Nancy. I have a small garden that I've had for about 20 years. And this spring, I planted different types of tomato plants in just this one spot. And they all die off at the top.
They died off at the top?
Oh. Nancy, are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, you're breaking up a little bit. So you said they died at the top? Oh, I think we've lost her, Barbara. But from what I gather, she said that they were dying in the top and she's even purchased new dirt and that didn't seem to help. Does that sound like something that sounds familiar to you?
You know, what we people who get questions and troubleshooting questions this time of year, and if you have tomatoes that are growing along fine and then they start getting very scant new growth and the new growth on the top is curly and twisted.
Yes.
It can be caused by herbicides either drifting in the air. For example, if a close neighbor had their lawn treated with herbicides under certain weather conditions, it can actually drift and,
yes,
and hurt next door.
Mm-hmm.
Or there can be residues in the soil and in the mulch. I have been going back and forth with this poor family in North Carolina who are losing their garden because of tainted horse manure.
Oh, my gosh.
Because the herbicide issue with tomatoes also can be traced sometimes to horse manure. Anyway, if Nancy is only seeing the problem on the tomatoes and not on beans, then we could kind of rule out that it was a herbicide, because the herbicides that cause tomatoes to struggle have the same effect on beans and peas.
Okay, okay.
It could also be a virus.
Yes. And
yeah,
there, what I would usually suggest is, Nancy, why don't you call the UW Extension office in, I think you are in Madison, so there's plenty of people here in Madison that can help you with that. Call the Extension. There's people that are bug experts and disease experts, and we have them on all the time, too. But give them a call. That's what they're there for, and they'll help you out with that. So let's go to Marcia. She's in Madison also. Hi, Marcia. What do you have on your mind?
Yes, I have a question regarding making reduced sugar jams. My kids now, they won't eat the jams with all the sugar, so I use the Sure Gel, and I use they have a suggestion of using apple juice concentrate and then stevia or Splenda, and it turned out really nice. But my question is, the only recipe they had is a triple berry, so it's blueberry, strawberry, and raspberry. Do you know, can you interchange and safely and use like all strawberries or all blueberries?
Yes, you should be able to, because there's not a big difference in acidity between the different berries, and so it will be fine to do that.
Oh, that sounds yummy, Marcia. We'd like to try that. Send over to Larry, and I would appreciate a jar. Okay, let's go to Pam in Nakusa. Pam?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, what's your comment today?
My comment is concerning Japanese beetles. I had gone to the Extension office in Wood County some years ago with that question, and one of the agents there had mentioned try using Carolyn clay as a spray.
Mm-hmm.
The Carolyn clay, I believe, was used in peach crops originally to stop sun scald. But if you spray it on your vegetables and trees before the Japanese beetles ring the dinner bell and invite all their friends over, it stops the invasion.
Hmm. Have you heard
of
that, Barbara?
They're having to eat dirt.
Oh, okay.
You see, with every bite of leaf, they're also getting a bite of dirt. And so it can be an effective deterrent. Of course, it turns your yard into kind of a ghostly place. And it would have to be reapplied between drenching rains.
Have you used it, Pam?
Yes, I've been using it for years. And if I use a sticker and use a good dose of it for the lighter rains, it does stay on. I do end up respraying, on occasion, but it works very well.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. Appreciate that. Barbara, have you used it at all?
No, I use it in winemaking.
Oh.
It's used as a clarifier in winemaking. But no, there have been some other products over the years that I've tried for different things that do coat leaves with a fine coating of clay. And it can work. It can work.
Okay. Well, we can always
now,
try.
Now, are you not in... You didn't just get Japanese beetles in the last year or two, did
no,
you?
No, we've had them for quite a few years. I think they've advanced to pretty much everywhere in the state at this point, but they've been around, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, it's usually the first 3 or 4 years that they're the worst. And then things settle down some. I think natural predators get in on the act. There are some wasps that lay their eggs on the forehead of Japanese beetles. Doesn't that sound great?
Insects are interesting, aren't they?
a brain-eating predator.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, we've got our insect expert on next Wednesday on our show, so we'll have to talk to him about if Japanese beetles are kind of going away a little bit or not. So that'll be interesting to find out. So listen, Barbara, and you'll know.
That's right.
That's right.
Mine are less. You know, every year the population is a little different.
Yes.
This year it's moderate. Mm-hmm. But a few years ago we had a terrible year. So, you know.
Yep.
You never know.
You never know. All right. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Amy from Milwaukee. Hi, Amy. What's your question?
Hi. This might be a kind of a bug question, but I guess it's a planting question too. I have an area of southern exposure. Spot in my garden that seems to just attract a ton of flies. And right now all I have there is yarrow, basil, and cilantro. I used to have sedum in that area, and the flies are just prolific, and they are all over, they had been all over the sedum, and I moved that thinking maybe it's just the sedum, but they're now all over the yarrow and the basil, especially, and I thought that the basil would actually kind of drive them away, but it doesn't seem to be doing anything. So I guess I'm wondering if there's another plant that would drive these flies away. It's actually just, I don't know what kind of flies they are, but they're, I don't really see any bees or any other insects, really. It's just these little black, they're like smaller than a house fly, but they look like kind of like a house fly.
Oh, any idea, Barbara?
No, I don't know what they are, but do they seem to be damaging the plants or just hanging out?
They're just hanging out, but it's pretty close to our rear door, to our back door entry. Mm-hmm. And so it's just kind of gross because we're walking by that area to get into the house, and you have to walk through this, like, mass of flies.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder what is attracting them. It's like you wonder if there's a dead frog down there or something.
I was thinking that myself, some kind of little dead body. But, you know, Amy, why don't you give us a call on Wednesday when PJ Leash is on? And I would imagine that he can help you out. And if you can get a picture and send that to us, that would be really, really helpful. Try that? Okay. Good luck on that, Amy. All right. Well, you're listening to a Garden Talk. Our guest today is Barbara Pleasant. She is an award-winning writer who has been covering organic gardening for over 30 years. I'm Jill Nadeau, and I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network. Do you have a question for her? Because we have open lines. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, we're talking about growing and preserving fruit, vegetables, and herbs today with our guest, Barbara Pleasant. And Barbara, you know, you've got a bunch of herbs that in your book that you say are good for your pantry and for preserving. Which ones are actually good for preserving? Because I know some of them, they just kind of lose everything when you try drying them. What's your secret for that?
Well, I do think it helps if you have a dehydrator to dry your herbs in the dehydrator at a low temperature. They'll be done in 2 to 3 hours, and they'll keep all of their color and most of their flavor. I would never think of hanging herbs up in a bunch and letting them dry at exposed to light and fresh air, they're going to fade.
Yes.
And maybe get spiders in them.
Or mold. Yeah, they're nasty.
Right. And so, for example, I dehydrate parsley. And one interesting thing I discovered a couple of seasons ago is that the curled parsley actually dries better than the flat parsley, which most cooks prefer the flat parsley. And I love flat parsley, too. It has more flavor to it.
Right.
But it does not dry nearly as well as curly parsley. So,
well, you've done all the research, and so if anybody's interested in what the best ways to dry herbs and which herbs are good to dry, they should check out this book. There's a lot of information in it, also on the different vegetables and fruit and how to preserve those too. Let's go back to the phones here. We've got John in Algoma. Hello, John.
Hi.
What question do you have for us?
I'm interested in finding something that I can treat my apple trees with to keep them from developing both scab and getting worms in the apples. That's organic. The family used to raise apples and used this witch's brew of chemicals, and it worked really well, but, Lord, you wouldn't want to eat the apple raw or unpeeled, that's for sure. And so where can I look for information specifically about serious organic treatment of apples and pears?
Okay. All right, John, our connection is a little bit scratchy there. Could you hear that, Barbara?
Yeah, yes, I could. And I know that it's a challenge. Now, pears under organic handling usually do pretty well because they do not have the diseases that apples have. Now, that said, using disease-resistant apples is an excellent idea. I have three apples, and all of them are resistant to apple scab and fire blight and a couple of other things. That doesn't make them resistant to everything, though.
Right.
So,
unfortunately.
You have to kind of get to know what it is that's bothering your apples. For the last 2 years, I put out coddling moth traps and also, what are the other little pests? I can't think of it. They're the little black flies, and they make little
yes.
holes. Mm-hmm. And you can buy pheromone traps for both of these pests and hang them in your apple trees. And I tell you, I think I've kind of knocked them out.
Oh.
I don't think there were that many to start with, and then they're gone. But now sometimes in areas where pest pressure is very high, people are actually bagging their apples with a plastic sandwich bag that's held in place, usually with a twist tie.
Oh, for each one.
And the apples grow inside the bag.
Oh, well, that sounds like a lot of work if you have a lot of trees. But
it is. It's
impossible. Wow. That's impressive.
But now, if you only had one little dwarf tree or two dwarf trees, right. It would be practical.
Yeah. But as far as actual sources where he could find more information on that, what would you recommend for him?
Well, because of the chill hour differential, you know, different varieties do like different levels of chilling. I know one of the varieties I grow, Williams Pride, is also recommended in your area. But I would go with the Extension Service recommendations because, like I say, having genetic disease resistance is so huge. It's going to make handling the apples and growing the apples so much more rewarding that's where I would start, is working off the list that Wisconsin Extension is going to give you and then say, which one of these has the most disease resistance?
Yeah, and as far as if you already have your apple trees, John, just maybe ask the Extension also about ways that they would suggest for organic sprays for the bugs and things. So good luck with that.
What one of the callers, when she was talking about the kaolin clay for Japanese beetles, similar products are made for spraying on apple trees. Serenade is one of them, and it coats the whole apple tree, leaf, fruit, everything with kind of a white residue, so it doesn't look very pretty, but it discourages a whole lot of pests.
Okay, there's one option right there. We've got Jeanette in Green Bay who has a question, too. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. I'm wondering what your guest
feels about companion gardening and how effective that is to increase flavor or production of the plants.
Have you done that, Barbara?
You know what? I've been in the middle of a project lately on companion planting. See, part of the problem is we humans, we are loving animals, that we we like to have good relationships with others, and, you know, it means a lot to us. Plants, not so much. They are solar beings that depend on access to light and space, and they cannot move. And so because of their life requirements, they tend to be unfriendly to their neighbors. They do their best to discourage other plants from growing nearby. So it is true, though, that sometimes things work better when they have company. One of the callers earlier talked about letting her radishes and lettuce go to seed. I let some cilantro go to seed, and those plants have been shading my mid-season potatoes. So there's a, and they do better. There's a beneficial relationship. There's some other clear examples. We grow a little bit of sweet corn, and when the sweet corn is about a foot high, I go and fill in any misses in the row with pole beans.
Oh, sure.
And the pole beans grow up the corn at just the right rate. And, of course, that goes back to the Native American Three Sisters.
Three Sisters, sure.
Right. One of the garden taught me that lesson years ago when I planted some pumpkins. They ran under the corn. I didn't plan for them to, but they did.
And it worked out great.
So there are definitely some combinations that usually can be explained in a spatial way. You know, the tall tomatoes are shading the peppers, which, you know, when the weather gets very hot, all of a sudden peppers just say, oh, no, this is terrible. But in terms of, you know, this plant loves this plant, well, no, they don't.
Okay.
Will they get along with them? Yes, and especially in a square foot garden or a real small space garden, you kind of learn through experimenting what can grow together.
Okay. All right. Well, have fun with that, Jeanette. Experiment. Let's go on to Bridget in Seymour. Hi, Bridget. You have a question about Japanese beetles?
Oh, no, just a comment. We don't really have them up here in Seymour, although I have heard that they're around the Appleton area. But we just came back from a trip to Missouri, and our friends near Lexington, Missouri, have a, our farmers, they had a cornfield that the darn bugs were in, and they put out shepherd hooks that he made and pheromone traps. In just the first day, they dumped those traps four times. And over the course of I don't know how long, they ended up filling up a kid's swimming pool with dead beetles after they dumped them in kerosene or something. But they said that the grub is smaller than a June bug grub, and it lives in the soil. So
yeah,
how do you...
Grassroots.
Yeah, that's, he was having, they had 5 inches of rain while we were there that day, so he couldn't spray the field, and the next day the sprayer came. So I haven't heard back yet how he's doing with his Japanese beetle.
Okay, all right, well, thank you for giving that us that update, Bridget.
Report from Missouri.
Yeah, my goodness.
Well, you know, because the larval stage of the Japanese beetle lives in the soil under turf, under grass, and they're the little, there are a lot of beetle larvae that are little curled white things called white grubs, but Japanese beetles certainly are. And you know, when I was talking about a lot of times when Japanese beetles first enter an area, for the first couple of years they're terrible, and then things get better. And that's in part because the larvae start getting attacked by fungi in the soil, And so their survival rate goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually apply fungus to the soil. It's called milky spore disease, and it comes as a powder. You just sprinkle it on. And it will make your lawn inhospitable to the grubs, which should result in fewer Japanese beetles all over.
Okay, well, there's another method right there. Oh, and you know, let's go to Jeff in Baldwin. I think he has some information for one of our previous callers. Hi, Jeff. Hey, Jeff, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, what did you want to talk to us about?
Oh, about the raised beds.
Yes.
I've been doing it for years. Right now I have 2x12s, and they're 4x8 beds. And what you do for the end, they're just regular 2x12 boards you get at the store. And what you do is you get a weed burner torch and a 20-pound cylinder of propane, and you burn the inside of the boxes, and that preserves it better than anything. And they're hard to burn sometimes, and I've gone down to, sometimes only a 1/8 or 1/16 of an inch burn is all I can get, and sometimes like a 1/4 inch, and they hold up just beautiful. There's no tips or nothing. And I've been using them now for over 7 years.
Okay, now are these certified for organic, Jeff?
Yes, it should be, because it's just charred wood inside.
Okay, and
when you're done.
I would not see a problem with that, and the charred wood would slow decomposition.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And like I say, I've had them 7 years now, and they've been working real good. Otherwise, anything else you put on them is kind of doesn't last long.
Right.
You know?
Okay. Well, great. Thank you so much for calling in with that. I hadn't heard that one before. Had you, Barbara?
No, I haven't, but it does make sense.
Yeah, totally. We're talking with Barbara Pleasant, and she is an award-winning writer who's covered organic gardening for over 30 years. If you've got a question about organic gardening, vegetables, or preserving fruit, herbs, vegetables, give us a call. We have a line open for you. The number is 800-642-1234. We've got Marie in Middleton on the line, and she is looking for Marie.
Yes, I have run out of ideas for my Red Lake currants. I make currant jelly and currant pie. Do you have any? Have you had any successes using red currants?
They make really good wine.
Barbara likes wine.
With an excess of fruit, you can put any excess of fruit into the freezer and later make either juice or wine. You know, it would be tart and need quite a bit of sweetening, but it also, I would go ahead and juice some of them and freeze the juice. And that way your options are quick and easy for what you want to make later on.
Have you tried drying them, Marie? Is that
I have not tried that. I thought maybe the seeds are so seedy.
Mm.
Do they get too?
That's a problem with seedy fruits, and you dry them, you end up getting results that sometimes aren't so good.
Okay.
I like to juice the seedy fruits, even some of my red raspberries. I go ahead and juice them and just have the raspberry juice. And I make syrups out of them, you know,
things like
that.
Yes, excellent. We had another caller who couldn't stay on, but she wanted to know about the use of horse manure for fertilizer, given that their diets might not be organic and contain pesticides. I think you had a little problem with that earlier, you mentioned.
Well, it's not so much what they're eating in their feed as much as there are some herbicides that are used to take care of nasty weeds and pastures that can pass through the cow or the horse in the manure, and then it can be devastating to a garden, and we're talking like 6 years before the soil is right again. Now, on the label of these products, there are these interesting graphics that are supposed to show anyone in any language how this risk operates, but I have trouble understanding it. Another problem is with if that gardener can get manure from a horse owner or goat owner or other animal owner, and they know how the animals are raised and what might have been used on the pasture in terms of herbicides, then there's nothing wrong with it. But the problem is information is lost on down the chain sometimes with manure supplies. So
like
it's
anything
best
else.
To know your source.
Know your source. That's so important with everything. Absolutely. We've only got about a minute or so before we have to break for the news, Barbara, but what's your favorite time of year in the garden?
I like fall. You know, you surprised me with your question. I guess I'm surprising you with my answer. I've just gotten starting a whole new flock of seedlings for fall. I have little cabbages growing, and so I'm already excited about it. The corn's not even tasseling, and I'm ready for fall.
Always a new project, right? Isn't that the way it goes with gardeners?
Right.
Yes, it just never stops. Well, fall is nice because you're also harvesting some of the things that you've worked so hard for all year to grow.
Well, and this time of year, vacancies start appearing in my garden. You know, when we pull up, we have the garlic up now, and the onions are coming in soon, and I'm praying that the squash will succumb one of these.
Well, we're talking with Barbara Pleasant. She is an award-winning writer who has been covering organic gardening for over 30 years. Barbara has written books on topics ranging from compost to weeds and is a contributor to the recently released Mother Earth News Guide to Vegetable Gardening. Her latest book is Homegrown Pantry, a gardener's guide to selecting the best varieties and planting the perfect amounts for what you want to eat year-round. Stay with the Ideas Network. There's a lot more to come. Talking about growing and preserving organic vegetables, fruit, and herbs today on Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Jill Najeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm sitting in for Larry today. On the phone with me from her home in Virginia is Barbara Pleasant. She's an award-winning writer who has over 30 years of experience growing and writing about organic vegetable gardening. Her latest book is called Homegrown Pantry, a gardener's guide to selecting the best varieties and planting the perfect amounts for what you want to eat year-round. What questions do you have about growing and preserving produce? What varieties are your favorite for preserving? We'd like to hear from you, so give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, you can post on our Facebook page. Just look for The Larry Mueller Show. And I said, Barbara, that you're on the phone, and we're getting some clicking, and we think it's from the thunderstorms in your area.
Yes, I'm afraid so. Yeah. We have unsettled weather today.
Yes. Well, we're used to that here in Wisconsin, too, so we understand. And we have had Harriet on the line waiting for us to come back, and she has a question. Go ahead, Harriet.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about my grapes. I have 4 grapevines. 3 of our purple variety, and 1 is a white Edelweiss. And all the purple grapes, all the grape clumps that were beautiful this spring are now riddled with anthracnose. And my question is, should I cut the grape clusters off because they are not going to be edible anyway?
Yes, I would. You know, whenever you have a disease that's just running wild like that, the less inoculum that's left around, the better. Boy, you really have had some rainy weather, haven't you?
Yes, unfortunately. I mean, it's good and bad. You know, things are growing like crazy, but anything to do with the disease concerning, you know, overindulgence of rain is not good.
That's right, and sometimes you've done everything right and then get the wrong weather, and it changes the whole outcome. But, yes, I would go ahead and clip off the diseased clusters and compost them. It'll just give you a little bit more reassurance that next year is going to be a better season.
Good luck with that, and hopefully that'll work out for you, Harriet. Barbara, You know, you are also involved, besides your pantry book, with the Guide to Vegetable Gardening that was compiled by Mother Earth News.
Yes, it's a wonderful book.
Yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit about that book?
Well, you know, I was a garden editor for 10 years, and I still work with Mother Earth News. But myself and Cheryl Long, who is the editor that recently retired, we were just kind of a team. And what that book, which is the new Mother Earth News Guide to Vegetable Gardening, it represents 10 years of some of the best garden writing in vegetable gardening. It's not just me. You know, there are other people. In fact, I'm sure that you might recognize, you know, Roz Creasy is in there, Lee Reich is in there, a lot of really wonderful gardeners who know a lot of stuff. And, you know, one thing that people don't realize about Mother Earth News magazine, everything is fact-checked.
Yes.
Yes. It's legit. And so in books, you do not get that level of authority often. And here you have material that has been fact-checked not once but twice and has been written by some of the greatest names of the generation. You know, when I got my first copy of this and shared it with my husband, he said, "If you can't learn to garden out of this book, you can't learn to garden."
Well, that was kind of my thought, too. It's a wonderful book for first-time gardeners, but people who have been gardening are going to get some tips out of it, too.
So many ideas in there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. I think we have Bob in Lancaster. Hi, Bob. What's your question?
Question, how do you optimize storage of whole apples over the winter? Like, if you should you pick them a little bit earlier before they're quite mature, and then you try and minimize CO2 generation somehow?
Well, it depends on what your resources are. If you had a whole lot of apples, you're definitely best off getting an extra refrigerator, even if it were one of these, like what college students use
dorm fridge.
Refrigerator. Mm-hmm. I do not have space for a second refrigerator, so I'll use coolers outdoors. Sometimes with frozen ice, frozen bottles of ice, you know, frozen plastic bottles as coolants. We do have a basement, which is totally adequate. If you can keep fully ripe apples cool, they will continue to improve in flavor. So they don't need refrigerator cold unless you're really trying to extend their life as far as a commercial producer might, and that's a special temperature regimen. But just using cool storage in the basement and some parts of the refrigerator, I can have apples and pears until January. And then after that, I'm glad I have the preserved version.
Sure, sure. Now, is there a trick to putting them? I mean, should they be in a single layer? Should they be wrapped in something?
You know, I think the important thing is to sort them very carefully so that only the best apples go into storage, ones that don't have bumps and bruises and holes. And it's funny how every time you go through your apples, you'll find another one. How did that get in there?
All right,
but once the apples are down, instead of trying to keep them, I try to, you know, use them up. We have three apple trees, so this year it's going to be a lot of apples. So drying them is a major thing I do with them, and I make some apple wine, and we put up applesauce and chunks of apples, and so...
Well, the apples are coming soon, so thanks for your call, Bob. We appreciate that. Let's go over to Andrea in Spring Valley. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Well, what's your question?
I have a question about making juice. I use a steam extractor for making juice from currants and elderberries and grapes, but it gets so thick it's almost syrupy. So I was wondering what techniques Barbara uses for making fruit juices.
Well, I have a steam extractor, too, but I only use it if we have a lot of something. You know, we used to have a pear tree that would bear every 5 years, and I would use it for the plums, and I use it for the apples, and to just get some, do one or two batches of the apple juice. But for small batches, I just use a stovetop and a pot and a heavy pot, and maybe a half cup of water, just enough to get the steaming started. And then mush the softened fruit and drain it through cheesecloth, and there's juice.
Have you tried that, Andrea?
Yes. Does it stay thick then, or is it kind of more juicy, or is it more like syrup?
No, but I'm wondering if what you're seeing are the natural pectins. Many fruits, like green apples, have a lot of natural pectin. If I were to juice some, there would be a lot of sticky residue that wouldn't be there with full-season apples. So, you know, you can always thin it with water, but a thick juice is kind of a blessing.
Why is that, Barbara?
Well, because it's going to be so dense, and it should be full of flavor and full of nutrients. And one of the great things about the steam extractor is the juice comes out of there so hot, you know, that it's about ready to seal in a jar.
Ah, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
We're talking with Barbara Pleasant, and she is an award-winning writer who has been covering organic gardening for over 30 years. Do you have any questions about growing vegetables or fruit or herbs? And what about preserving them? What have you been trying to preserve that you've had problems with? Give us a call. All the lines are open. The number is 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. How did you decide which vegetables and fruit and herbs to put into your pantry book, Barbara?
Yeah. Everybody grows currants in Wisconsin.
Hello? Barbara, you
hi.
There? Yeah. How did you decide which vegetables to put into your vegetable or your book?
Well, I tried to include almost everything that people might want to grow. There are some foreign herbs that have kind of entered America in the last few years, and they're not in there. You have to kind of draw the line somewhere.
Right.
And there are not tropical vegetables. And so it's kind of like what would most American gardeners want to grow? And just kind of took it back from there. You know, compared to the plant list when I started gardening, you just grew boring old things. You know,
right.
Green beans, corn, tomatoes. And now, you know, it's a lot of Asian vegetables, and Chinese cabbage is great for fermenting. I'll have to put that in my fall garden. And so we have arugula, for example, I'd never heard of when I started gardening. So.
Yeah, I don't think most of us had, but you're right. It's nice to have that wonderful variety. Now, in each type of plant, we have all these different varieties that are now available. Did you do some experimenting with which ones would actually preserve better than others?
Well, some of them do preserve better than others. For example, if we wanted to talk about green beans, there's a group of beans called the French green beans that are filet beans, they're called in seed catalogs. They're very thin and they're very delicate. A disaster when you're wanting to make pickled green beans.
Yeah.
Green beans. They're wonderful fresh, but they're not for preserving.
Right.
And so, you know, it just varies. Of course, that said, I've never tried fermenting them, so for all I know, they're great.
Ah, well, that's something for you to try next time. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Terry online with us from Roberts. Hi, Terry. What do you have for us?
I just have a comment that we've been drying our tomatoes successfully for the last couple of years and just wanted to give that advice to people with too many tomatoes.
How do you dry them, Terry?
So my husband made two fairly large, well, actually, we've got more like six now, but large screens with the nylon mesh. And so we cut mostly Roma tomatoes about a quarter inch thick at the most, and not too thin, but about a quarter inch thick. And we lay them out on one screen, and then I lightly salt them, and then we sandwich the other screen on top of that and clamp those two screens together and put them on sawhorses and let the sun dry them out naturally. And we let them get not real dry, but kind of a leathery to slightly mushy, and then I bring them in and coat them in some olive oil, some balsamic vinegar, and some garlic powder, and then I freeze them.
Oh, those sound so good.
That's good, doesn't it?
Yes.
They're delicious. They're absolutely delicious, and so I use them all winter that way, even on fresh salad. So we don't even buy tomatoes in the store in winter anymore.
Why would you when you have those, right? It sounds wonderful. How long do those usually last, Terry?
Well, we freeze them. So you mean for how much we keep, or what do you mean?
Well, you freeze them, so do you? Are they good for a year, or don't they last that long?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They're great out of the freezer. You just thaw them and use them in cooking or fresh on a salad.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that with us, Terry. Appreciate that call. Barbara, have you done sun-dried tomatoes?
No, you know, my climate is so humid.
Oh, is it?
That
yeah,
I use
I suppose
the dehydrator
it would be.
For drying everything. One thing that people who are new to drying tomatoes, I should point out that after they've been in there a couple hours and they're maybe not even halfway dry, they reach this mushy point. So if you say, oh, they're just turning to mush, that's okay. Just wait. and everything will turn out okay. You have to actually leave them and not try to turn them or touch them or anything until they're almost done.
Okay. Well, good to know that way. Otherwise, we might be throwing away good tomatoes. We've got Marcia calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcia.
Hi there. I have a question. Thyme is my favorite herb, and I don't grow a lot. I just have two pots going every year, and I'll use it fresh, or I'll, you know, cut it. And like some people, I don't hang them upside down, but I put them on a cookie sheet on the top of the refrigerator to dry the thyme. But the challenge I have is it's so tedious to get those, and time-consuming, to get those little tiny thyme leaves off of the sticks, and I'm wondering if you have any, you know, nifty ways to strip the
I get frustrated with the fresh thyme because it seems to me the hardest to get the little leaves off the sticks, and so I will often cut a handful of thyme and just leave it on a plate at room temperature, and it'll be dry in 2 days. And the dried thyme is a lot easier to take the leaves off of than the fresh thyme.
I found that too, right. And if you go backwards, you know, on the leaf with your hands, sometimes those little leaves will come off too. So against the grain. So have you done it that way at all, Barbara?
Yes, or even if you can even put the, let's call it countertop dried thyme, between your hands and
right,
you know,
and it comes off. Yeah,
yeah, kind of swish.
There's a name for that.
I'm
not sure.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to think of.
Yeah, I'm doing it here in the studio and no one can see me, so but I know exactly what you're talking about. Well,
yeah,
well,
but it was kind of an accidental discovery that wow, if I just leave this dried there, it's going to be a whole lot easier to cook with. So.
Right, and it still contains the same flavors, right?
Right.
Right. Okay. We've got a call from Les in Cottage Grove. Hi, Les.
Hello there, young ladies.
What's your question?
I'm from Howard's Grove with an H.
Oh, Howard's Grove. I'm sorry.
And I didn't realize this was a vegetable show, but I'm calling about my flowers that are on the southwest side of my house that I can never, they always seem to wilt, no matter how much water I give, no matter how much fertilizer that I give, and this is like 5 years already. I never can seem to keep my perennials alive for more than a certain amount of time, a year, basically.
Oh, my goodness.
And I've done a soil test, and everything says that it's all in the right area. So can you help me?
Barbara, do you have any idea?
Are you getting unrelenting sun all day?
I'm going to say no. It's, you know what, it's a southwest side. My house is not perfectly north, south, east, and west like I would like it.
Yes.
So I have to kind of look to the, yeah. I'm going to say, yeah, it's probably 10 hours.
Ooh, that's a lot.
See, you have a lot of sun. So which flowers, is there anything that has done well?
Well, I wish I could tell you the name of it. I don't remember the name of it. It's a very broadleaf plant that gives me one yellow flower that sticks out about 24 inches away from everything else. And I have that next to a black oak tree. I wish I could tell you the name of it, young ladies.
Is it maybe like a yucca or a... Is it kind of looks cactusy looking, the leaves?
No.
No. Okay. Well, that was a guess, so I have no clue. But that does sound like a lot of sun, doesn't it, Barbara? I mean, could it be that maybe the plants he's planting need shade?
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, without knowing what's been tried and what might have done well and what failed, it's kind of hard to guess. What to do. I certainly would veer towards just playing with annuals and things that don't cost a lot in terms of money and time until you get the site so you understand it better.
Right. And again, you know, I'm not sure exactly where Howard's Grove is, but I'm sure there's an extension office, a county extension office somewhere, and they may even be able to come out to your house and give you a better idea of, you know, what's going on there. So they're the experts. And if you're right there, I would say, you know, try to connect with them less. And good luck. That has got to be so frustrating. All right. Well, we have, a listener named Luva from Madison called to ask, what vegetable seeds can she plant right now?
Well, you can still plant green beans up for about the next week. You can still plant a few fast-maturing warm season things like bush snap beans or a very fast summer squash. And then it's time to start thinking about fall and start up with kale again and start up with chard again. And, in fact, chard can take the heat better than other greens, and so it's kind of a year-round green. So I wouldn't hesitate to get started with that. And let's see, beans. This comes up because people will sometimes dig their early potatoes and say, okay, now what?
Yes. We're done now, right?
So, yes. And so, you know, you're going to get a whole other salad season coming up. And it's funny how once the days start getting shorter, they seem to get short so quickly.
They do.
So fall is going to be here before you know it. And one of the things that new gardeners don't quite get, because we talk about fall gardening, they think you wait until it's starting to feel like fall and put in a garden.
Right.
When in fact, you know, all of these things need summer's heat and they just finish in the fall. So
that's right. And I think a lot of new gardeners don't even realize that you can plant later again. You know, you can have like two or three plantings and still so utilize that entire garden. So, well, Barbara, it has been a pleasure to talk with you today. Hopefully we can have you back on again real soon. Barbara has two new books, The Mother Earth News Guide to Vegetable Gardening and Homegrown Pantry, A Gardener's Guide to Selecting the Best Varieties and Planting the Perfect Amounts for What You Want to Eat Year Round. Thanks to Michelle Johnson for on-air production and to Dave Potras for technical direction. Our physical therapists are back on Monday, so make sure you tune in then. I'm Jill Najo, sitting in for Larry today. Thanks for listening to Garden Talk.